When it's cold and snowy, it's not a great time to start a major home improvement or building project, but it is an excellent time to plan. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. We'll talk about planning and designing your next project. Whether you're building a new house or remodeling an old room, we'll talk about the things you should know before you get started. Who needs to be involved in the planning process? If you're building a home, how do you design with the site in mind? We'll answer those questions and more. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. January is not a great time to start a home improvement or a building project, but the cold, snowy days do give you a good opportunity to plan. Bill McAnally is the housing specialist for Iowa State University Extension and our home improvement expert. He's here with us today to share his wisdom about planning and design and, of course, to answer your questions. Hello, Bill.
Hey, good morning, Charity. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being with us today, although you're not actually in the room with me. I missed that.
No, I'm actually up here in the hinterlands up north, and I thought I'd check something for you. I checked northern Minnesota's weather advisories, and, you know, they tell you about the weather, and one of the lines is wrap up your kids, and the next line is be sure not let your cats out because their tips of their ears can freeze in a couple minutes.
Oh, wow. So we should feel fortunate down here, you're saying.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about planning. I know that's something you've been thinking about and giving workshops on that subject recently. Is the planning step something that a lot of us don't pay enough attention to when we're starting a big project?
Yeah, it really is. We've been really lucky here the last couple weeks, and it's going to be ongoing for a few weeks yet. We've been working with Aligned Energy. They have a green building summit where we've been doing workshops in several cities, and the attendees are builders and heating and cooling, you know, professionals and electricians, plumbers, and that. And it's really neat because we're in a group of professionals and meeting with them and talking with them, all of us have kind of agreed, you know, that we just want to get working. We just want to get going, and let's break ground. But then we really don't spend enough time on initial planning phases and incorporating, you know, the customer or the homeowner or person you're going to be remodeling for in a lot of important decisions that in the long run will, you know, kind of streamline the process, speed things up, and especially when we have to look at if we're building new, meeting certain building codes and the energy codes, where if we make decisions later in the process, you know, we may be able to slow, what would happen is if you make a change, it may slow the whole process down by, you know, maybe even a couple weeks. Or longer. So we've all kind of sat there and thought, you know, we really aren't spending enough time in the beginning bringing in everybody that's going to be working on the project. You know, like a day like today, you'd get everybody there easy because you'd offer some donuts and some heat and they'd be there. But that's what makes winter good. But we just aren't getting a lot of those decisions made up front.
And what's important about having those meetings? I mean, when you start a major project, like say you're planning to build a house.
Yeah.
Obviously that is the idea. You kind of know what you want out of it, but are we not deciding exactly what we want to get out of it before we get started?
That's exactly what's happening. Is let's say you purchase a lot, and that's usually what happens. Is somebody will have a lot, and then they pick a house plan. Well, we need to get started earlier because a lot of times we'll pick a house plan that doesn't fit. We like the plan, but it doesn't really fit the lot that we've purchased. So you really kind of have to look at what are my personal needs. You know, I'm talking as the consumer, the homeowner. You know, what are my personal needs? What do I want to get out of it? Do I want to be looking specifically, say, at energy savings, having a healthy home, durability, the view, the neighborhood, how close is, say, the local church and shopping? All those things have to be taken into consideration before you pick a site. And there's a lot of occasions where you'll buy a lot up front, let's say, and then you pick out a house plan. Well, a house may not fit on that lot, or it may not comply with certain, you know, rules or zonings, or like in a lot of subdivisions, covenants where, you know, you could, like in my case, you know, if I have a pickup with the name of a company on the side, you can't park it out in your driveway overnight. It's just one of the rules. So all those little things have to be brought up in the very beginning. And then one thing we've also not done in the past, especially in residential, is we don't do enough testing of the lot. We'll look at, say, a site plan, and it shows, yeah, it's fairly flat or whatever, but you don't really know what's underneath there. And a lot of times as a builder, we run into huge expense of hitting soils that aren't good, or maybe a house that was buried there, or farm tiles. So there has to be a lot of research in the front end, you know, of what are my needs? Is this plan going to fit, you know, where I want to live or pick the lot out? And people have to really look inside themselves, especially, do I really want to leave the neighborhood I'm in and maybe jump up and maybe mortgage costs or whatever? Do I want to live in a, maybe out in the country more and be around more trees? We've had cases where people would move from, you know, a pretty close neighborhood, move out into a subdivision where there's a lot of trees and that, and they don't feel comfortable. You know, they feel they've watched, I don't know, maybe watched too much TV, but they just feel threatened by all the space, people being able to, you know, maybe come in from the back through the woods. You know, you wouldn't think that, but we've seen people live for a year in a house and move just because of that. So you have to really look inward and think, you know, what do I really want to get out of my house?
Well, and I suppose when people talk about building their own house, there's sort of this idea of, if I'm starting from scratch, I can get everything I want.
Mm-hmm.
But you also need to get your priorities in line, because you're going to have a little bit of give and take.
You are going to have a lot of give and take. And usually it happens on the budget side. People will set a certain budget and say, this is the maximum amount I'm going to ask. And it's funny, we were in Fairfield, you know, last week in one of the sessions, and I said, okay, now we've met with the customer, and they've set their budget. And I asked, okay, what do you think they always go over on their final budget? And it was just like everybody agreed, and it was the same number I had in my head. It was 15%. You set that budget down. You said, I'm not going to go a penny over, and it invariably it seems like they go over at least 15%. And so you need to explain these things to the people in the very beginning. You know, this is what happens. I know you're locked into that number, and in reality, you're going to make a lot of changes, and maybe you're looking at more living in the house the rest of your life. You have to be designing for, like, say, universal design, which is going to change the floor plans and change materials. And there's all those decisions, and that's why everybody has to be brought in the very beginning.
And let's revisit that, because yes. When you say everybody needs to be brought in,
yeah,
who are you talking about?
What I'm talking about is the homeowner, of course, and if they've already, and this is what they need to do right away too, is, you know, do the research and find out who they want to have as their builder or general contractor. And the subs, the subcontractors that are going to be involved, who's the plumber, who's the heating person, who's the electrician, so that they have a face, to that they know who they're working for, not just the contractor. But it seems like everybody does a little bit better job when they know who they're working for and, you know, what kind of desires they want. They get to know them personally. And then you find out what are their skill sets. That's another thing. You may have to eliminate someone that's involved in the process, because just for one example, the International Energy Conservation Code is throughout the state of Iowa. You would ask, okay, is this insulation person going to install the insulation to the building or the energy code? And if they kind of glaze over, what? I don't, you know, you mean I have a code I have to follow? And you may, you know, either you're going to have to educate yourself, or we'll have to find another person. And then they will also make suggestions. You know, they'll say, let's say the subcontractors will make suggestions. You know, we've used this product in the past. We're very happy with it. It's not what you're looking at, but, you know, maybe you should do some research. I'll get some information on it. You may be happier with what we've used in the past and not as happy with what you're picking out, because you're just maybe getting some information over the TV or whatever, and not practical long-term advice.
Is there sometimes reluctance on the part of the people involved in the process to get together at a meeting like that? Is that a hard thing to accomplish?
It's getting better. It used to be, yeah, you know, because we as builders, including myself, you know, that's all we want to do is just get out there and start digging and building, and we don't really like meetings. I didn't like meetings when I was, you know, teaching and stuff. You know, that's a waste of time. I don't need to go to that. But we really, you know, I think we're starting to see it in the industry that everybody's getting a little bit more contact with each other, and I don't know if it's because now that we have smartphone technology where we can, you know, quickly get a hold of the homeowner, you know, take a picture of something or send them an attachment of a product or a question, you get immediate feedback. Whereas before you'd have to wait to the end of the day or something like that. I think a lot of that technology is becoming involved. And therein it ties in with the homeowner. They feel very involved when they know that they can get a hold of anybody in the process and send suggestions and get pictures back or information back immediately. And so they need to know, like, to get together up front, face-to-face, so they actually can identify who they're talking with or communicating with.
Well, and you mentioned site-specific information mm-hmm. as well. What are some of the big pitfalls you see? Because I think in a lot of areas, especially in areas where things are pretty flat, contractors come in, builders come in, and they put the house on the lot without a lot of time taken to think about what's underneath and what the orientation might be. What are some of the pitfalls you see when thought isn't given to that?
You know, that's a really good question, because we see this issue a lot. One of the biggest things is, water. What is the water table in your area? You know, you dig down a couple feet, you hit water. Okay, now what are we going to do? How much excavation we're going to have to do to bring in rock for drainage. Is there anything buried on that lot, especially if you're doing a lot that's in, you know, an existing part of town, it's an infill lot. Did they tear a house down? Did they leave the foundation there? Did they leave the concrete floor, you know, the sewer, the water, you know, just things like that. But we've been finding out with a lot of, let's say in subdivisions, you know, they'll come up and just like you're saying, you've got this bare lot. Well, you know, they might come out and just skim all the black dirt off and move it off to the side and sell it back to you, or level the whole area. Well, if they level it, and then you look at the site plan of, you know, you purchase your lot, you get a plan of the elevations and that. Look at the date on that site plan. And if it's pretty recent, you need to ask the person you're buying a lot from or do the research yourself. Go back as far as you possibly can. Go to the County Soil Conservation Commission where they've got maps of, say, underground drainage tile, things like that. But go back to old city planning sites, and maybe there was a ravine there. Maybe there was a dump site there. Maybe there was all these things in the past that you're looking at a site now that's the topographical map is what it is now. You're not looking at what it was, say, 30 years ago. So there's a lot of questions. So there's
all right,
a lot of
Bill, we need to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to home improvement expert Bill McAnally. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm here today with our home improvement specialist, Bill McAnally. And, of course, he's also here to answer your questions about any projects you have on your horizon. The number to call is 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, Bill, before we get on to questions, we've talked a lot about if you are planning to build a house. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's a situation a lot of people find themselves in their lifetimes, but not everybody, but almost everybody does some sort of major home renovation at some point or another. Do you have some advice for that kind of planning process?
Yeah, you know, one thing that's been coming up here in the last few months is, you know, different types of insulations, especially that people look at when it gets this cold. You know, my house is cold, maybe I should look into re-insulating the house. Do as much possible research as you can on different products that are on the market, different types of insulations, different methods. Do your due diligence and find out, you know, who is probably the best insulator in your area, the best person, the best record. And one thing people have to remember, if you have an older house, and we have a lot of them out in the country that have the old knob and tube wiring. It's, you know, if you're in the attic, you'll see these two black wires and they hook the little porcelain knobs That was originally just for lighting when it was first installed, and maybe one receptacle for, you know, a couple maybe a stove or something, light stove downstairs. But then they would incorporate, just tie off that old knob and tube wiring. People have to understand that if they still have that in their walls and their attics, they cannot insulate up against it. So if you purchase an insulation that is blown into your walls or blown into your attic, the insulation cannot touch that knob and tube wiring. A few years ago, I was just like every other builder. We thought you could just, cover it up. It cannot touch. That's the Iowa Electric Code, which is across the whole state of Iowa, tells you, and they're standing behind that you cannot put insulation in a wall that touches that. Now, how can you do that? You're either going to have to rewire or find a way to keep the insulation away from that wiring by building fireproof chambers basically around the wire, which is dang near impossible in a wall, and it's very time-consuming in an attic. So just don't go out and have it, people come in and say blow or pour some type of product inside your walls. You cannot do that. And if people say, oh, yeah, we can, we've done it for years, no, you can't, because there's a lot of instances where that wire gets warm, gets hot, and you can either start a fire or cause some severe damage.
All right, so not at my house.
Yeah, that's scary.
All right, if you have a question for Bill McAnally, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We have an email question. I'm working on remodeling my kitchen, which is very small and separated from the rest of the house. My idea for connecting the dining and kitchen spaces is to remove the drywall from the wall and build custom shelves between the studs, leaving the studs visible. Is there any reason that we couldn't do this?
Really, no, not that. I mean, you're still leaving your support. I've seen some pictures of that, and when it's done correctly, it really looks, I think it really looks cool. They really aren't changing anything structural. They may run into some wiring issues in case there was some wiring going up or down, or in the older homes, sometimes they use the space between the studs and the plaster as an air movement section for either driving warm air up or bringing cool air down for their heating and cooling. So they have to kind of take a look at that, and just be sure if it is an older house, you may run into some lead paint, so you're going to have to take the appropriate measures to prepare protect yourself from lead paint and anybody in the area. But that really wouldn't be a big deal.
All right.
Sounds pretty neat.
We have Eric on the line from Dallas Center. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to talk about?
Well, I just was thinking, a tremendous money saver, time saver, headache saver is to hire an architect as you start the process.
Okay. Yeah, in some cases, people will. It just depends. There's so many options. A good architect can really help you in the design phase, especially like you're saying. And architects seem to have a real knack at finding out what the customer needs. A lot of questions on, travel patterns. How do you live? Do you eat? Do you spend all your time eating in the dining room, which hardly any Iowans do? Or do you spend eating at, a small table, or eating maybe at the counter? Those are the kind of things that an architect can handle. Plus, an architect, is very good at knowing, the codes, the zoning, and build and design build people kind of do the same thing. But an architect usually brings in the code issues a lot better than most, especially the energy code and the residential building codes.
Eric, thanks a lot for your call. And Bill, yesterday when you and I were chatting, you mentioned that at these conferences, at these meetings that you've been going to, you've been hearing from a lot of builders and contractors who are telling you that they're having a hard time finding out what codes they need to follow.
Right.
Is there a big communication problem here?
It is. And I feel one of the presenters, there's three of us that do the presentations. I cover like best building practices and this design and planning stuff. And then Dave Ruffcorn is actually from the Department of Public Safety. He's the energy code official for the state of Iowa. So actually he's kind of in charge of enforcing it. That's just one person for the whole state. And, it is funny. We'll ask, like yesterday there was 70 people in the crowd. And I asked, okay, how many people know that the International Energy Conservation Code covers the whole state? And it was like five or six people. really knew it. So it is. It's just something that you would think everybody would understand, but they don't. And so, you know, that's where, again, you have to ask in the planning phases, does everyone here at this table know the codes we have to follow? And they are available. I mean, it isn't something that's, you know, just not there. At these sessions with the binder, they get the whole code book, which is nice because then everybody was there gets the new code book.
Mm-hmm. We got an email from Dean in Ames who says that 20 years ago we built a house using a very reputable builder that I knew personally. Several things make a home building experience a good one. First, the client should always remember that it is their house, not the contractor's.
Yep.
They should get the advice of the builder, but they should always make the decisions themselves. Second, before any changes are made, meet with the contractor and decide what is to be done and who's going to pay for it. Three, monitor the construction. Visit the site every few days to check on progress and indicate interest to the builder.
Yep. Those are, you know, if we should ask him for the list because that's exactly what, you know, you would really want is exactly what he said. A lot of times homeowners especially, you know, they kind of feel, well, they may be a little timid. They feel like, well, I don't really know much, so I'm going to rely on this person to tell me what they're going to do. You have to kind of get a little more bullish. And the big thing he said is you have to remember it's your money. You're living in it. They're not, you know, the people here aren't designing it for themselves. They shouldn't be, at least. So it's your opinion that matters the most. You know, you've got the purse strings. You're the one that's controlling this, and they have to understand that in the very beginning. And I used to always ask the people to come by every day if they possibly could to see the changes, because sometimes you get too far along in the process, then it's major change. If you catch it early, it's easy. So, you know, I like involvement all the time. You know, we would like, hey, come by anytime you want. You know, it's, mm-hmm. you're not bothering us any. We're building it for you. That's good. You know, those are really good ideas.
We have a few lines open for your calls right now. The number is 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send an email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And, of course, any question you have about your home is welcome. If you're concerned about heating at this time of year or have some insulation questions, things you'd like to fix for next year, give us a call at 866-780-9100. And we do have a question about a gas-burning stove.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question. In a house, they have a wood-burning fireplace in the basement, a wood-burning stove upstairs, and the person who owns the home doesn't burn wood in the one upstairs because he doesn't feel that it's safe, and they've never really had it checked out. But he was looking into gas-burning stoves. They have a gas line nearby, called up the company that sells them, and didn't get any response from two different companies. And he's wondering if there's something that he needs to know about connecting a gas-burning stove.
Yeah, I would have a plumber hook that up because there could be some issues, especially health and safety issues on that it's easy to hook something up sometimes just connecting some fittings, but there's a whole realm of issues that come into play. I was talking with a friend last night, and she had talked about there's a furnace that's coming out. It's a gas furnace that doesn't vent outside. Now, there's no way that's possibly can be healthy. And so a gas stove, you really have to be careful of how much air is coming into the house for combustion. You know, and then where is it coming from, and then where are the combustion gases going? Because any fuel, when it burns, gives off combustion gases. Are they being vented correctly? And in the past, we've seen issues where people will bring a small pipe in from outside, and they'll say, okay, here's your combustion air. It's just a pipe just stuck, you know, a hole right through the house. Here's the air that this appliance needs to burn for combustion. Well, houses go through different pressures, even pressures from outside. Sometimes that, instead of air coming in, air goes out from the house, and then that pipe can become a better chimney than maybe what is involved with this gas stove. And carbon monoxide then can flood the house. So I would have a professional look at that, hooking that up. And if this company isn't getting back to you, I'd forget it. They may not be reputable. And you need to go to the Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, sometimes to get really good information on things that aren't safe. And they've put out a lot of warnings on certain products that are marketed like crazy and over the over TV and newspapers that they just blatantly say do not use these products. So that's another place when you do some check. But I'd hire a professional to put that in. I wouldn't touch it myself.
Okay. And if you hire a professional, how do you know it's somebody who is fully qualified to work with a gas line?
They would be a plumber. I mean, they would be a licensed plumber with the state of Iowa. You'd need to make sure when you hire someone that you ask them, are you licensed? Are you bonded? Are you insured? Yes. Okay. And then check some references. But they have to be licensed. It's not just some friend down the road. That knows how to put a couple fittings together. In cases of life and safety, like stoves and combustion gases, you have to make sure that they are licensed with the state of Iowa.
All right, and if you had somebody put it in who wasn't licensed, I would guess that that could compromise you with your insurance if something were to happen.
Yes, and wood stoves aren't looked on very well with the insurance company, and some gas stoves. You see these gas vent-free gas heaters. Those are really scary. Insurance companies hate those because vent free just means that you're burning something inside your house and all the gases are staying in. And when they're brand new, they may not give off much carbon monoxide or very little at all. But yet, as they age or if they get bumped or knocked down, all of a sudden it can be a completely different scenario.
All right. And so if you do have one of these installed, it sounds like you're also recommending that you make sure you have a carbon monoxide detector close by.
Yeah, and make sure it's a good carbon monoxide detector. There's a lot of rumblings going around that some of them only go off when you've already reached a level that you'd probably be asleep by then anyway. So that's kind of something that's just now coming out. We would always say, be sure to buy a good one. Well, we're going to have to do a little bit more research and find out exactly what brands actually go off or warn you at low levels, not at elevated levels. And we're hearing a lot of people, and I'm hearing a lot of people from the industry saying, hey, we need to step back a little and find out which brands actually are working like they're supposed to.
All right. We've got a lot of callers on the line now. Liz is calling from somewhere in Missouri. Hi, Liz.
Hi,
what's your question?
I had a question regarding building a home ourselves. My boyfriend is planning on building a cabin on his parents' property.
Okay.
And he's a carpenter, so he's planning on doing the work himself. We bought a couple books of home plans. One is a book of home plans from Lowe's.
Okay.
And we were thinking of purchasing a plan from the book. And I was just wondering if you have any suggestions or ideas or book advice that maybe we are not thinking of when we are going to build this cabin on our own.
Yeah,
and I know that's pretty general, but.
Oh yeah, I tell you what, there's an awful lot of building your own log cabin books. I've got quite a few on the shelf I'm looking at right now. I would recommend that, if he's never built with log cabins, there's actually, if you could find the time, there's like week-long schools or 10-day-long schools. I know Missouri has them because Missouri and Arkansas are very good. I mean, the climate's a lot milder. You don't worry so much about heat loss down there. But I know there's one in Isabella, Minnesota, that's very good. And I'm sure there's some in Missouri where they walk you through the whole process. Plus, during January and February, there are log home seminars that you can look at different companies, too, and get different ideas. They're usually in the northern tier of states, but just Google log home seminars because I know there's some going on in Minnesota and Wisconsin right now. They're usually two-day sessions. Check with your insurance companies, and then you're really going to have to really look at what kind of logs. I think down there, a lot of the logs they usually use oak, which are great. Look at that house plan, and like we were saying earlier in the show, is what kind of do I want a huge vault up there? An open balcony from up above coming down, and you have to remember there's a lot of maintenance with a log home. Especially if you're building them yourself, you have to really allow for raising and lowering of the logs. There's a company in Minnesota called Schroeder Log Supply, and they sell products and information. They'll help you with information on how to acclimate your everything for the raising and lowering and the drying of the logs. That's usually where the process kind of becomes stumbled when you move in, is is how much those logs actually move up and down through the seasons.
Does that help you out a little bit, Liz?
Yes, yes. Thank you very
much. Sounds like a big project. Good luck with that.
Thank you.
And we will get to more calls after a break. We're going to take a break here quickly, but I'll read a Facebook post from Gail first. I'd like to suggest that everyone test their home for radon right now. A kit from the Lung Association only costs $10, and if your home needs to be mitigated, that would be a great spring improvement project for a certified mitigator. Radon-induced lung cancer kills approximately 400 Iowans each year, and I myself am a radon-induced lung cancer survivor, so...
Good.
A great comment from Gail, and last year we spent an hour talking about radon, so I know that's something that you take very seriously, right, Bill?
Yes, I do.
All right. We will take more calls in just a moment. We are going to take a break. The number to call with your questions is 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Home improvement expert Bill McAnally is here with us today. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here today with our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, and we have a lot of people with questions on the line at 866-780-9100. So let's go to Sharon in Johnston. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. I have a question. I'm a senior, and I'm looking for this perfect developer for senior citizens. I've looked into accommodations that are, you know, subsidized, but my income is a little bit higher than what I qualify for.
Okay.
And so as I've looked around, and I don't even know where you go to look, I would love to see some development where you buy a place that maybe has two bedrooms, you know, a country kitchen and a living room and a basement and a double-car garage and close to grocery store, drug store, hardware store, doctor, or clinic. You know,
sure.
For a senior citizen development like that, I don't think they exist.
They're very rare here. It seems like they're all Del Webb, you know, things out in Las Vegas and Phoenix. You're right. But yesterday, when we were in Cedar Rapids, there were two builders that were in the group that's kind of what they're specializing in. And, you know, and I don't know if they're in the Cedar Rapids area, but they were there at this session. But they're specializing in kind of 1,300 to 1,400 square foot homes. They're doing universal design and they're keeping the cost down. And I don't know if they're doing them in subdivisions or what, but, you know, I know that there's some builders, at least in that area, that are kind of building that type of house. But I don't know why Iowa really hasn't gotten
into
that.
With the amount of older people that we have, and we don't want to go into institutional care.
No.
You know.
No.
And I'm in the metro area.
Okay.
In fact, in Johnston. So.
Okay. You know, that's a good question to bring up. You know, I would maybe get a hold of the Des Moines has an excellent home builders association. I would get a hold of the Des Moines Home Builders Association and see if there's anything in the works or bring it up, you know, because they maybe have someone that would like to do a subdivision, and if they had enough interest, they could do one. But they just, of course, you know, kind of there, they don't hear of anybody that wants it, so they don't build it. So I would, if you're in that area, I would get a hold of them and ask them. They're very receptive.
All right. Good luck with that, Sharon. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Jim on the line in Grinnell. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Hi. I have a house built in 1946. It's all brick and block, literally no wood in the perimeter.
Yep.
They lost.
No, Jim, you're...
Oh.
Oh.
Did we lose him?
No, well, he thought we lost him, so...
Oh.
He hung up. Jim, give us a call back if you can hear us now. Let's go to Sanders in Knoxville. Hi, Sanders.
Hello.
Hi there. What's your question?
I have a question about my septic tank. Someone has advised me to put a root killer in it, a foaming root killer.
Oh, no.
Is that a good thing to do.
You mean they wanted you to clean the septic tank out and put a root cellar in it?
Oh, no, 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 no. She said a root killer.
Oh, are you kidding me?
A root killer. A foaming root killer.
Well, you know, there are some root killers, but I don't know if I would put one in. It depends on the chemical makeup, because for septic systems to work, they have to have, you know, bacteria.
Yes, it says, I did buy the bottle,
okay.
And it says that it's safe for septic systems, but it's got copper.
Now, who recommended this to you? Was it a septic specialist?
He's a fellow that cleans drains, and he did to remove some roots between the house and the septic tank, and it's copper sulfate,
okay,
pentahydrate.
Okay, you may want to double check though with your county sanitarian. They have regulations. Call your county sanitarian first before you put it in, and make sure it's okay with the county, because they have jurisdiction over septic tanks.
Okay, but you think it would not harm the septic, the bacteria and so on, if it says that it's okay?
That's why I'm kind of recommending get a hold of a sanitarian, because what it says on a label, you know, sometimes may not actually happen. I can't make a judgment call on that, so that's where I would defer back, because if I was to say, yeah, mm-hmm. It works, and the county sanitarian call me up and read me the riot act, they're the ones that have the jurisdiction, so you better check with them first. If they say it's okay, then it'd be fine.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Sanders, thanks a lot for your call, and I think we've got Jim and Grinnell back on the line. Hi, Jim.
Hey, you're right.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a 1946 bungalow kind of house that was built entirely out of brick and block.
Yep.
There's literally no wood in the perimeter.
Okay.
And clearly the outside walls conduct a lot of cold more than heat, obviously, in this climate.
You bet.
And I've checked on the web, the only place I can find anything that's reasonable other than putting, you know, furring strips and all that in, like you do in a basement.
Uh-huh.
If I want to insulate the walls, everything is made in the UK, because they apparently have more stone and brick houses than we do.
Uh-huh.
Is there anything you're aware of that is reasonable without making the walls incredibly thick that I could do on the interior?
Yeah, I did a house a few years ago, exactly the same thing. It was a big two-story. In fact, it was old enough it didn't even have indoor plumbing at the time, but it had all walnut trim and gorgeous house. And what we did on that particular building is we attached foam, extruded polystyrene, to the inside of the walls, and that you don't have to use furring strips with. You can just mechanically, you know, with special screws and that, you can attach, like, say, 2 inches of foam to the inside, and all you have to do then is just extend your jams, you know, for your windows. The nice thing is when you do come inward, that at least when you pull the trim off the walls, on the outside walls, that all the dimensions become smaller, so you can still, you know, put your trim work back on. But you do have to add extra extension jams on your windows. You would not believe the difference it made on that house, because it stopped air. We didn't have moisture, you know, vapor issues, and you stopped pretty much stopped your thermal bridging across that
right.
That wall.
And you extended the electrical outlets and all that, and obviously too.
And the nice thing is, if you haven't rewired, that's a perfect time to do it, because then you don't have to, you know, go through a whole lot of processes. You can do rewire all your outside wall receptacles and switches at the same time.
All right, good luck with that, Jim. And next up, we're going to go to another Jim. This time in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hi.
I was helping my son inspect a property that he wanted to buy, and the homeowner had said that the water had come up in the basement, and I was noticing that it had gotten quite a ways up into the water heater that they were still using.
Ooh, okay.
And I had said that I didn't believe that was something that should be, you know, in use today.
Right.
I don't know if people don't know that. I think you're agreeing with me.
Yes.
And the other thing I believe I saw was that old aluminum wire from the 70s.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of scary stuff, too.
It is scary. And, you know, there's a lot of it around, and a lot of it is safe, you know, considered to be safe. But it is kind of scary, and it, And, you know, if you can, a lot of times it isn't that hard to replace it if it's accessible. I'm not an electrician, but I hear a lot of horror stories about aluminum.
Yep. Well, I think kind of retains a charge. It heats up. Maybe somebody thinks it's fine, and then they add something like an air conditioner.
There you go.
And the next thing you know, they got smoke coming out of their walls. So
it's common for us. We always tend to overload everything.
Sure.
You know, we never have enough breakers.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks for your.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. So, Bill, if a water heater gets water in it in a basement flooding situation, is that kaput?
If it's if it's just a real quick wetting and you can get it dried down, you know, you might be okay. I'd have it inspected. But if it's been underwater, you know, if it's had a few wettings and there's any rust down there, you know, you can just have all kinds of issues with that because the combustion area is down in the bottom. It also depends, you know, a lot of times people will throw it away, but it would be an electric water heater and they don't have combustion. So, you know, I'm sure he's talking about a gas water heater. After looking at a lot of the things we saw in the Missouri River from the floodings, I would not use it if it's been wet for very long at all.
All right. Kevin's on the line next from Roland. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
Heating, air conditioning, ventilation question, I guess. Basically, we live in a two-story home. There are four bedrooms upstairs, and I had a guy in looking at the furnace, just a checkup on that a little while back, and he said he didn't think that the return vents from the upstairs bedrooms are actually tied into the furnace, into the where it should
sure.
have the air returning into
sure.
you know down in the basement.
Yep.
And so I guess my question is there a possible way? Would it be possible to have that done? What would it be involved in that? How much more efficient would things be if that was done? Or is that just a bad way to have things? Designed?
Yeah, it is a bad way because you should have the equal amount of supply going in as you do return for things to work properly and not rely on, say, you know, the undercut of the door going in the bedroom to give you some air movement. There should be, you know, how old's the house?
Oh, just a second. Kevin,
About 18 years old or so.
Okay, you may be able to frame in either some soffits or, you know, bulkheads along the ceilings or frame in around in some corners to give your HVAC guy some place to run some ductwork to get up there. And when you do that, make sure that he seals that ductwork, that he uses a mastic to do all of the joints on that so you can move all of the air you're trying to move and it's not leaking out. And then make sure that whole system is balanced, that heating and cooling system is really checked for balancing. And it sounds like, you know, he's saying, yeah, we need to get some duct for that. You know, that means a lot to me because a lot of times it's not worth the time. So I would recommend that you go ahead and get all that, you know, try to find a place to run some ductwork up there and get that tied in.
All right. Good luck with that, Kevin. We've got Judy on the line next from Oxford. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'd like to find out if radon can go through concrete. I've got in-floor heating. The floor is 4 inches of concrete.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so
radon.
Can radon go through?
Yeah,
that?
Radon can go through concrete. It goes through it just like it's not even there. It just goes a little bit slower, because concrete's very porous. But if you have in floor heat, they may have. Is this in the lower level?
Yes, there's no basement.
Okay, so hopefully what they've
second story.
Yeah, hopefully what they've done is they put a vapor barrier underneath the floor. But I would get a radon test made, and if you don't have a basement, they can still hook up a mitigation system if you get a reading that you feel is high. The EPA level is 4 picocuries per liter, which I know the picocuries per liter doesn't mean much, but you want to look at that number. Now's a good, like we had a caller or emailer before, now's a good time to be testing for that. But I would get a test on it because the concrete doesn't even slow up radon.
Thank you.
You bet.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Judy. We've got a lot of email questions to get through here as well. This is an email from Jim in Boone. We have an older clear-story barn that we'd like to convert to a living space. It's in pretty good shape, straight, and apparently strong. It has water and electric that was installed in the 50s.
Huh.
Are there people that you know of who could advise us on the viability of a conversion like this, and what factors would be most important when considering a barn conversion?
There's a case where you may bring in a designer builder or an architect that maybe have some experience. There's some really good books out. I think one of them is by the Taunton Press on it's kind of like Barns to Homes or something. I think that might be the title. There are a lot of considerations, especially on the capability of the wood that's existing to carry the load and what kind of shape it actually is in. Because barns inherently, you know, were wet and they had, you know, animal feces, things up against them. And so you have to have that, especially that structural wood tested to see if it's viable to carry loads, if there's dry rot, especially in the lowest levels, and what kind of a foundation is there. It's pretty easy for a foundation to carry a barn, but when you start putting in, you know, live loads of people and more dead loads and things like that throughout the structure, that the structure may not hold it. And if it does, if it's close, well, you can still reinforce it and make it viable.
Okay. Then there are some really cool homes out there that have been barns at one
time.
Oh,
they're gorgeous.
So.
I have a friend that had was going to do one up in northern Wisconsin looking over the Lake Superior, but he never got around to it, which he would have.
We've got an email from Casey in Volga. He says, I'm looking at installing a pellet stove. I've compared both my insurance company installation requirements and the pellet stove manufacturer recommendations. My insurance company is treating a pellet stove installation as equal to a conventional wood burner. Is a pellet stove equal to a wood burner, and what would the difference be?
Well, I would think that they would, I can see why they would consider it to be the same because of the venting process, and you do get extreme heat in those pellet stoves like a wood stove. It all comes down to the manufacturer, how good they are, and especially the installation, because it doesn't matter how good of a stove it is and how good of a fluid is, if it's not put in correctly, I can see why an insurance company gets very, very nervous with those. I haven't seen as many pellet stoves lately as we have because of the cost of the pellets. But that it comes down to that manufacturer, and you're really going to have to talk to your insurance company. And, you know, I can see they're still going to ding you no matter what. And then you're going to have to decide whether if there is going to be savings for you, if they're going to offset the rise in insurance.
And again, on the safety side, how do you make sure that the person installing this for you really knows what they're doing?
You know, wood stoves are a little bit different animal, and pellet stoves, it is really hard to find somebody that really understands that. You may have to get some information from your insurance company that they will have a checklist of what this installer must do and what qualifications and what training that he's had, and you would not think you'd have to go through this whole process, but some insurance companies require that. They want to know exactly what kind of training this person's gone through to be able to put it in. And there again, it comes down to someone that has to have enough experience to understand how you live and say what kind of fans are inside the house. You know, when you kick on a fan, maybe it'll backdraft this pellet stove and deplete oxygen. There's so many variables, and that's why insurance companies get really nervous around wood stoves, wood fireplaces, and pellet stoves.
All right. Well, Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Enjoy that Minnesota January.
Yeah, thanks.
We'll enjoy the Iowa one. Maybe we'll see you in person next month.
Okay, I hope so. Thanks,
all right,
Charity.
Thanks a lot. Home improvement expert Bill McAnally. Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, it's Horticulture Day. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.